Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you from all over the world. Today, we're going to learn about how even a minimal amount of exercise can still help prevent disease and prevent weight gain and help you if you're a menopausal woman, University of Missouri, and how soy protein, we're talking about non-genetically engineered organic soy protein, earlier in life you start consuming it, the better your bones are going to be later in life, University of Arkansas Medical Science Center, and how cacao, which is chocolate, fair trade, organic, is really good for your cardiovascular system, improves the biomarkers. Who says? Brown University researchers say. And a new study links proteins in wheat to the inflammation of chronic health conditions. Finally, they're getting it right, hence gluten-free is important, and this is from Gutenberg University in Germany. And we're also going to look at how edible petals, that means edible flowers, are really important. And this is from Polytechnic Institute in Portugal and more. And then we're going to have a take a look at our environment, including America's southeastern forest. They're being decimated to supply energy for Europe. Well, that's not cool. So how bad is it? How many acres are they deforesting? We think of deforestation, we think of the Amazon. We think of the boreal forest of Canada, Russia. No, we're talking about North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. We're talking about Alabama. Wow. And exactly why are they taking this wood? I'll tell you about it. Also, for New York City, how bad is the water surge and flooding going to be? Well, it's going to be upwards of 9 feet. That's a whole lot of water. Now, that doesn't mean buildings would be flooded. It means that the infrastructure upon which the standard and quality of life depend upon for 10 million people would be so adversely affected that it would make New York City a ghost town. That's going to happen. And also, if you knew that you could help prevent suffering in other people in making a product or mining a product that you use every day, like cell phones or computers, would you be willing to stop buying those and even to protest on behalf of those people who risk their life to get you that mineral? I'll give you an insight on that also. And then I'm going to give you my latest assessment on why I believe that the mainstream media, in cooperation with governmental agencies, has been misleading us about the true state of our economies. We don't have one economy. We have seven. I'll tell you about those seven and where we're at. And also, what about the mega drought that's now in play? It's happening to the southwest part of the United States. I was recently traveling just the last few weeks in the southwest, several states, Texas, Colorado, for example, Florida, and across, and I saw nothing, zero, not a single thing that led me to believe that the governors, the mayors, the town councils, the legislatures were properly and honestly educating people about how non-sustainable the future was, even right now. I did some surveys in Texas. I'll tell you how many people are living right now as we speak in a non-sustainable way and what we can do about it to help them. Then from our audio files today, it's rare that we find someone on the BBC that actually tells the truth in a way that challenges the BBC. Well, they brought on a Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos to talk about Syria. Now, we hear even on Pacificus, misguided programs about Syria on some, and Libya about how it's a good thing and praising the white helmets. Well, the white helmets are not to be praised, and I'll explain why, that they're actually terrorists. And boy, how easy it is to fool the left. Wow. But I'll get into that in a moment. But he told the truth. Now, when you tell the truth on the BBC, they generally have gatekeepers that keep you off the air. It's very rare that you'll see a Chris Hedges or someone who can tell the truth in a convincing way and has the evidence to support it. They'll have some so-called liberal on, like Juan Williams, who calls himself a liberal on Fox, to offer some balance to the highly radicalized fascistic minds I hear all the time there. Well, they're all fascistic, in my opinion, when I hear them. So let's hear what this BBC guy laid on the people watching it. And also, right now, people are wanting to help the hurricane victims in Haiti. And clearly, there is no help there. But we're going to go through the same routine. The Clintons jump in. People give the Clinton Foundation money because they're supposed to be overseeing everything in Haiti. Now, Haiti's a sovereign country, so why does the President of the United States select someone, Bill Clinton, to in effect be the overseer of everything in Haiti, the most powerful person in Haiti? Well, that's what you do when you engage in hegemony. So we have an audio clip from the former president of the Haitian Senate explaining what happens when Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton raise money and what doesn't happen in Haiti. And also, how about a drug made to kill black women? Never heard of that? Well, we're going to show you that drug and the black women that are being targeted to be killed on today's show. Not conspiracy theory, reality. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's begin. Most Americans who exercise very well. If you go to malls throughout America in the mornings, you'll see that the malls frequently open early before the stores do, where they have security guards, but it's a nice controlled temperature, and people go and do power walking. We're talking about a lot of people. In fact, I remember doing a national race in a mall in Connecticut early in the morning. And it was kind of strange because we were zipping up one end of the mall and then zipping down the other, and you had to turn around. The floors were kind of marble-ish and slippery. I'd never done that before. But then I found out how many people go there on a daily basis. And then it's all over the country people are using malls, and that's a good thing, to exercise or wherever you feel safe and where the weather allows you. People who go to the gyms almost always have a routine. They know what they want from that experience. They want to gain strength, chisel their muscles, burn body fat, have more endurance, be healthier, live a longer life. So those two groups, the ones that are doing power walking, which is more than any other exercise in America. In fact, it's more than all other exercise in America combined. If you took everyone jogging, biking, playing tennis, put them together, more people power walk every day. What the problem is all the people in America who are not exercising at all, and that's the majority of Americans. This is from the University of Missouri, and it says, research has indicated that metabolic function is critical for women to prevent cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes after they reach menopause. Now, according to a new research, University of Missouri, minimal exercise may be all it takes for postmenopausal women to better regulate insulin, maintain metabolic function, and help prevent significant weight gain. These findings suggest that women who take a proactive approach may not need to increase their physical activity dramatically to see significant benefits in exercise. So, here's the takeaway message. They say, go on a regular walk. Take the stairs rather than the elevator. Joining beginners fitness programs. And I absolutely agree with that. not everyone has the mindset to go out there and really get into great shape. The older you get, the less likely you feel that you're capable of doing that. You look at your body, you feel your energy, it's diminished, and you think, well, this is not going to get any better. That's not true. It can get better. So if you just started to walk, and even if you made a request of people living in your neighborhood or in your building, you'd like to form a little walking group that can take walks together. That would be terrific. So my suggestion, power walk, a half hour a day, 5 days a week. It'll help remineralize your bones, helping prevent osteoporosis. It controls hormone levels, reducing the amount of estrogen, so you're less likely to have the estrogen impact upon breast cancer. You're going to burn more inner body fat, which reduces your body index, which is your fat percentage, because quite simply, the higher your fat content, the faster you die. It's that simple. So all good when you power walk. And something else that's good is eating some soy protein. Now, I'm talking about organic, non-genetically engineered soy as just a part of an overall good diet, not predominant in the diet. You could have some soy protein. You could have some tofu, some miso, some tempeh, a soy shake. Here's what it will do, according to the University of Arkansas Medical Science Center, published in the FASEB Scientific Journal. Quote from their study, soy protein early in life might be what's needed for strong, healthy bones in adulthood. This is what the new research shows. And it also protects the bones. So, quote, this also is the first time that scientists have used in this model to show concrete evidence of a protective effect on early life soy protein isolate diet on adult bone loss, which means that if you have these foods early in life, you're going to be far healthier when you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, and on. And that's good. Now, something that's very tasty is chocolate. Now, of course, there's different types of chocolate, and there's different percentages. The higher the percentage of pure cacao, the more medicinal benefits it has, and especially if you get it without dairy and the processed sugars. This is from Brown University, published in the Journal of Nutrition. It says, quote, a number of recent studies employing various methods have suggested compounds in cacao called flavanols could benefit cardiovascular health. Now, a systematic review and meta-analysis of 19 separate randomized controlled trials of cacao consumption reveal some further pieces of supporting evidence. The meta, which means many, analysis in the Journal of Nutrition, an assessment of the combined evidence from all 19 studies, focused on whether consumption of flavonoid-rich cacao products was associated with improvement in specific circulating biomarkers of cardiometabolic health as compared to consuming placebos. And, quote, our meta-analysis characterized how cacao flavonoids affect cardiovascular metabolic biomarkers, providing guidance and reducing diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So, here it is. You don't have to have a lot, about 2 ounces a day, 2 ounces of good quality chocolate. There's lots of chocolates out there. There are hundreds. But just look on the label. Read the label. Is it vegan? Does it have processed or non-processed sugars? Does it have chemical additives? Is it fair trade? Look for that and then consume 2 ounces a day, and you're going to have a healthier heart. Less likelihood of having elevated C-reactive protein, elevated triglycerides. So that's good. And finally, from the Gutenberg University in Germany, a study that found that the protein in wheat triggers the inflammatory reaction that leads to conditions including, quote, such as multiple sclerosis, asthma, and rheumatoid arthritis, and also contributed to the development of colotic gluten sensitivity. Now, that's important. So the idea is, first and foremost, always get gluten-free. Secondly, there are grains that are actually more nutritious and more versatile, such as quinoa, spelt, amaranth, and millet, to mention some, but not all. So that's gives some really good scientific verification. I also believe that there's something else to it. I believe that if you're eating something that is grown naturally without artificial fertilizers, that is allowed to be raised to its full ripe condition, and then eaten in its whole form with all the roughage, that you'll have far less likelihood of having a reaction. I believe that part of the problem is in how items are grown and processed. I'll give you two examples. Whenever I travel to Europe, and I'll be going to Greece in about 2 months to help with the Syrian refugees, I'll specifically be working with a team of 8 and on supplying them with the children with nutrition. I'm making arrangements now to get them the type of nutrition package used to, for free, of course, that will help them so they don't suffer from gross nutrient deficiencies and quality proteins, so that as poor as they are, and many are suffering, if not almost all, from malnutrition, at least they will have something. So I'm working on that. Anyhow, when I'm there, whether it's in Greece, Spain, Portugal, Italy, France, doesn't matter, you will find that when you eat their grains, especially those with people living in the countryside, that I, for example, will have a delicious pasta. I will watch the sauce being made and all the different olives and different ingredients and herbs that are placed in it. And in one case, I actually was there for 2 days and I saw the wheat being harvested, grown organically, and then ate it the next day. I saw them stone grinding it. It was really neat. No reaction at all. None. But then if I eat a processed wheat out of a box that was not grown organically, I would get a gluten reaction, fatigue, and with me, it's just fatigue. Now, I was upstate one day. I wanted to do some photography. That's one of my quiet hobbies I do, is nature photography. And there was this gorgeous apple orchard, and it sat on this little ridge. And then there was a steep drop-off. And from that ridge, I was photographing out through the black dirt farms of Goshen, New York. And these are the richest soils on the planet. That black dirt can go down 30 feet. When you walk on it, it actually moves. And I had a black dirt farm that I owned up there, 200 acres. That was the one many of you, thousands of you came up, and I give all the food to the churches and people take them back to their shelters. It was a wonderful experience. So there I am, and I see these apples. So I asked the guy, I said, could I buy an apple from you? He said, yeah, take one. I said, thank you. Now, I knew what would happen. My nose would get a little red. My earlobes get a little red. But I thought, what the heck? It's a beautiful fall day. I want one of those crisp apples. So I eat the apple. Nothing happened. Wow. So I ate another apple. Nothing happened. The guy had an apple press, and he gave me some apple juice. I drank the apple juice. Nothing happened. I thought, well, by golly, that's neat. So the next day, I'm back in New York City, and I walk by a stand, and I buy an apple, and I washed it and bit into it, and boom, instantly came back. And then I tested myself, and I found that it wasn't the apple I've been allergic to these years. It was either the paraffin wax or the pesticides that are sprayed on it. Apples are heavily sprayed. So bodies will frequently react to what is added to a product, not necessarily the product itself. I found the same thing was true for oranges. And an organic orange, unsprayed. Now, they dye oranges. And the reason they dye them is because If you ever have a fruit tree, let's say a citrus fruit tree, lemon, grapefruit, orange, you'll notice that it's never evenly colored. The side of the fruit that is always facing the sun is going to be a deeper color than the one that faces inside to the tree that is not going to get sun at all, in which case you can have like speckles of brown and green, but it's still good. Now, you can't sell that because people want an evenly colored fruit. When a worm eats its way out of an apple, there's a little scab on the outside. Scabbed apples. Completely nutritious. Nothing wrong with them, but aesthetically, people don't want that. So they dye these and to make them uniform. So then you find out you're reacting to a environmental biochemical sensitivity. And in America now, we're finally recognizing that far more people have chemical sensitivities than we have suspected or acknowledged, because we are living in a sea of toxins. Just something to think about. So think of all the things that if you ate them organic and in their natural state, you would have a different response in the body. Now from our environmental segment, this is from Adam Macon from Alternet, and it's an article called America's Southern Forests Are Being Decimated to Supply European Countries with Energy. And it talks about how Hurricane Matthew, in the aftermath of devastating flooding across the Carolinas, has been a dramatic example of the cost of communities having to spend in the face of increasing impacts from a changing climate. And it's yet another reminder that it's time to get serious about addressing global climate change and reducing carbon into the atmosphere. But in the past 60 years, 33 million acres of natural forest in the southeastern United States, many of them are coastal wetland forest. Now, what that means is that a coastal island with trees on it that used to have down at the base of the Mississippi and across Louisiana, and they would bear the brunt of these storms and absorb the water. Because if you don't have these islands and these trees and these marshes absorbing the water from the rain, then where's it supposed to go? It's going to go on land, and then you get a higher negative impact. And so they had destroyed these. And as a result, there was greater consequence to the Hurricane Matthew. And what happened was that Europe had such a demand for our wood that they started opening up all of our wood. In fact, they took so much wood that it's the size of West Virginia, 33 million acres. That's huge. And so that threatened over 600 species. So no one was aware of this. Who knew this? And how it happened was that in 2009, the European Union, wanting on the one hand to increase renewable energy and reduce carbon emissions, passed a new energy policy. And this policy considered any and all biomass materials renewable energy. So it created a major loophole for energy companies, allowing them to now burn forest wood from industrial timber operations and power stations and receive government incentives to do it. It raised a critical question: where would Europe get all that wood to feed a growing demand? And energy companies quickly turned to one of the world's largest wood-producing regions, the southern United States. So in just a few years, the southern United States has become the world's largest exporter of wood, the preferred form of biomass for industrial use. Last year alone, more than 5 million tons of wood were exported from the South directly to markets in Europe. And this arrangement has had serious impacts on the climate and communities and forests of the region. Now, here's what we should understand. First and foremost, the idea of promoting biomass as a clean, green energy is simply not correct. Using only waste wood and providing massive carbon savings was the idea, will use sawdust, but they didn't use sawdust. They used hardwood trees, oak, locust, cherry, maple, the hardwoods, the woods that last a long time and grow a long time. So in recent years, industrial biomass companies have been exposed by organizations and for this sourcing of whole hardwood trees from endangered wetland habitats for their wood supply to send off to Europe. And the notion that biomass is a carbon-neutral energy source is scientifically unsound and based on serious carbon accounting errors. And in fact, though we think of biomass, a source from wood trees, we don't realize it's 400% worse than coal. Let me repeat that. Burning biomass is 400% worse than coal burning for the climate. It's a major problem for industrial biomass. Since there's no possible way to meet Europe's current demand without logging whole trees. Now, what I would suggest is the solution is, in the United States, we should have local and state and national protest to stop all culling of hardwood forest. I was appalled when I saw that somewhere between 450 and 550 black bears have been killed in New Jersey in the last 2 weeks. This idea that somehow you're doing something good by killing these species is nonsense. The same is true for the idea that, well, we have these giant forests and it's an economic opportunity, so let's harvest it. Oh, there's some minerals out in the ground. Let's harvest those minerals. That's how we got into this mess to begin with. And unfortunately, the policymakers are almost always able to influence the vast majority of legislators to give them the permission to do this. And if the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the TTRP, if any of these passed, you would have no protection of any of our resources ever again. And we would have super sovereign oversight, meaning our laws, our rules, our Supreme Court could not overturn what another country, a company in those countries, wanted to do by exploiting their products here or our products. So one more reason to be concerned about stopping global warming. Now, if we want to put all of our energy into stopping coal and stopping gas hydrofracking, then it's going to have to come not from those of us not involved, but from people living in places where hydrofracking, like Kansas. It has now been confirmed yesterday that the worst earthquake they've had there and the multiple earthquakes they're having are due to gas hydrofracking. The same was also true in Oklahoma, that has the most earthquakes of any state in the United States. In fact, it used to have no earthquakes, and it had thousands thus far this year, and they're getting worse. Now, what's of interest, and this is something I'd like to get your feedback on TalkBack, is if we, the environmentalists, those who are conscious of these issues, if we're able to educate ourselves on the dangers of clearing hardwoods and pumping out gas and oil from communities, yes, it will give some work, but look what it does to the quality of life. Now we know that methane and other materials are causing environmental diseases in the communities in which this is exposed. No different than when the Native Americans, the Navajo, were hired at cheap labor to work the uranium mines during and after World War II. They knew at the time that it was going to cause disease, mainly lung disease. They hid this information, and only later, after most had died, did they acknowledge it, but they were forced to acknowledge it. The government did not voluntarily acknowledge it, nor the private corporations got the contracts to do this. When you realize, for example, in Africa, one of the largest centers of death in the 1950s and 60s came from mines that were mining uranium with no protection nor warning to the workers. And later, those are the people had massive amounts of birth defects, stillbirth, miscarriages, and cancers of different types. So here's the question. How, and I'm asking you for a solution, how do you move people in their own interest to stop something that clearly will cause them and their families, children, adverse health? Because the people protesting are not the people where these incidents are. I could never get the people in my home state of West Virginia to protest against black lung or then brown lung, the chemicals coming out of the Kanawha Valley from Charleston, West Virginia, Bluefield, clear up past Weirton. Now, I lived in Weirton. I live in Steubenville. I live in Wheeling, West Virginia. My hometown was Parkersburg. It's a very small area. You could drive from the end to the other in about an hour. So you saw all these people, and yet no one would ever protest because they wanted to work. So how do you get states to ban fracking when the citizens will not support that initiative? What is your solution? What do you propose? And then extrapolate that to all the other issues that we have to deal with. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Solutions to helping change the laws to help stop manufacturing or processing that is clearly against the environment and the animals and human beings. I'd like to hear what you had to say. Now, this is the latest, and it's a major study talking about considering the coming mega drought in America's Southwest. This is from Gaius, and it says that much of the water that sustains California, southern Nevada, Arizona, and surrounding areas comes from the ever-drying Colorado River. Just as it is now clear that we've passed the tipping point for extreme weather, we're also very likely passing the tipping point for the long-term habitat of the American Southwest. This is based upon NASA's latest report that was released by EcoWatch, and it was called NASA, Mega Drought Lasting Decades is 99% Certain in American Southwest. And this was also released through Scientific Advances. So, here's the larger issue. I've traveled throughout Colorado, Wyoming, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, all these Southwest states, trying to get a handle on people living there. And I'm going to focus for a moment on two states, Colorado, where many of you are listening right now because I've had 34 separate programs on PBS in Colorado, and just got a letter yesterday, by the way, the documentary Seeds of Death about the dangers of GMO has played over 60 times. That's a record. They can't even remember any documentaries ever played more. And it's a strong documentary, if any of you have seen it, against GMOs. And it's getting people to become aware of an issue because of the impact of GMOs in our life. But in any case, also down in Texas, I was able to find 1,200 communities in Texas representing over 6 million people. So this isn't small, 6 million people, 1,200 communities that are now no longer water, and I'm only talking about water, water sustainable. I'm not talking about the high heat. I'm not talking about it's so hot that where historically they could grow cotton. Cotton can't grow. Alfalfa can't grow. Brown rice can't grow because the soil is too hot and they don't have water. I'm talking about communities that are having to bring in water tanker trucks where they had lakes that are now just empty, dry. And yet there is no plan to bring water to those 6 million people. The only thing they're doing is taking water from northeast Texas, which has plenty of water, and bring it over towards Dallas. But then people are going to be charged a huge amount because that's a p- public-private project, which means the private part makes the money. The public part pays for it, or most of it. So what do you do with all these communities? Then you go up and you see that Kansas is in drought, Colorado's in drought, upstate New York, half of all the counties upstate New York are in drought. It was interesting because at a lecture I did about 3 years ago on homesteading, so many people wanted to attend, I had to do it over a period of 8 weeks, and every Saturday was packed. And someone said, well, we're going to move upstate New York because up there you got unlimited water and you can grow everything. And I explained why I would not move upstate New York. And I gave them my reasons, because I had lived upstate New York. I had tried for 13 straight years to get a local community to give me zoning so I could turn a 50-acre homestead that I have, an organic teaching farm. I wanted it for children to be brought up from the inner city on the weekends and then be exposed to farming and how food is made, grown, like whole grain Asim breads, and be able to take that stuff home with them, but also give them information, let them be around animals so that they see the love of an animal. There's nothing cuter than seeing a kid go over to a little cow, and the cow comes over a little heifer and starts kissing the kid. Well, I want to tell you, that kid just wraps their arms around the little heifer, and they don't want to leave. And the same with the miniature horse. And then we explain, here are these chickens jumping up in your lap and allowing you just to pet them. And they just calm as can be. They just sit there. Well, that's one way to see an animal, a sentient being. Another is to see it, you know, as fried chicken or barbecued ribs or veal, Parmesan. And so once kids see this, it's a very easy, soft message and not to want to buy that. And for one summer I did it, but they kept coming up and, you know, telling me I couldn't do this. I didn't have the zoning. So everything I tried to do, I couldn't. So I finally just said, fine, I'll go to a place I can. And I did. And never had a problem again with that. And I believe that we need some really important teaching habitats, green habitats, around New York State that kids can come with their parents or guardians or teachers, school teachers, bring them up on the weekends, let them spend a whole day in nature and see everything that can help them, educate them. I thought it was a good idea. I still do. But I also saw water tables, and I saw drought. And I'd driven up to Maine. And when you go up through there, if you're driving, you see beautiful trees on the road. If you take a plane up, you'll see massive deforestation. Not because they've cut it for timber, because disease has destroyed it. When you get temperatures too hot, beetles take over. And beetles are to a tree what cancer is to a weakened cachexic immune system. It's devastating. So right now, there is nationally registered, state-declared drought emergencies in all these counties, dozens of counties upstate, and it's not going to get better. Is there water up there? There is water in some areas, absolutely. But there's also drought. And now see how you have to have an irrigation system capable of supplying millions of acres. There is no such system. It'd be too costly to do it. So just remember that if you think it's a great idea to go up and do homesteading in New York, I would say no. But there are places to do it. Now, when you go back down, you go into Nevada. No water at all. None. It gets out of Little Colorado. In fact, upwards of 30 million Americans rely upon their water from the Colorado. And the Colorado, look at Lake Mead. Look at the Colorado. It's way down from where it was, and it's not coming back because global warming means that there's less snow, and with less snow, the snow that's there is going to melt faster. So you'll have flooding when you don't want it and where you don't want it, but you won't have a sustained release of snow as water and then going into irrigation systems. Then you have water wars. Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, South Dakota, Utah, Colorado, Kansas, Texas, 80% of California, except for the northern section. these are simply not sustainable in the future. There is no plans right now. And on the one hand, you can understand where if you're a governor and you told people the absolute truth, if you brought in Paul Beckwith, if you brought in Guy McPherson, if you brought in the people who know the science, and they're going to tell you the truth. They're not going to give you a politically sugar-coated. They're just going to say, look, your developers here, they're taking massive land. They're putting in developments. They sell quickly because people want to live in this environment. But then there's no water for them. So how in the world are you going to have people living in developments with no water? So everybody lies because the state needs you to live in California, pay those property taxes to pay for its bloated budget, whether these expenses are legitimate or not. When you move and someone buys your house at far less than what it was before, taxes go down. So without a tax base, bureaucracies don't function the way they should. Not everyone is served. And that's happening across the Southeast, the Southwest, but it's not obvious because more people still want to be in these places, and these people don't care if there's been hurricanes or tornadoes or sandstorms or drought warnings. They don't care. They want their dream. And okay, for a while, their dream is there, and then it becomes a nightmare. So for this audience, I'm just telling you the places I would never move. Visit? Sure. Move there? No way. It's not coming back. Let me explain that again. Colorado, Utah, Kansas, they're not coming back. They're dying. It'll be a slow death, and those who have the most money and resources will be able to move around and adjust in that environment and exploit it. But everyone else? No. No. In your lifetime, you will see these environments being incompatible with quality of life. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you to this program, sharing a lot of information and putting a lot of articles up. More articles than what we've ever put up. Dozens and dozens per day by categories. The categories that you have told us, whether you live in Ireland listening all every day, or you're in South Africa, or you're in Singapore, we're paying attention. So we supply those progressive-minded articles. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com. Go to the different articles on all the topics. Also, for you who would like to listen live over the telephone at noon, Monday to Friday, let me give you the number, 515-605-9429, 515-605-9429. Now, let's hear a talk on the BBC. This is Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos talking about Syria.
Papadopoulos, editor of Politics First and an expert on Russia. Do you think this country is Russophobic?
What can I say, first of all? The House of Commons debate demonstrated just how MPs are deluded, uninformed, and quite frankly biased when it comes to the conflict in Syria. And the only people who are benefiting from that ignorance and delusion are Islamist terrorists in Aleppo and elsewhere in Syria. And we must remember that those Islamist terrorists who are receiving the backing of the West pose a terrible threat to the British public, and they want to carry out scores of London-style bombings. But when we talk about Russophobia, certainly Russophobia, racism towards Russia, has a long history in Britain. It goes back even to the Crimean War, and it was there during the First World War and even during the Second World War. And Boris Johnson's comments, his call for protests outside the Russian embassy, not only contravene diplomatic protocols, but they're, quite frankly speaking, they're very dangerous because they are encouraging hostility towards the Russian diplomats and the Russian diplomats' families. And if any harm comes to a Russian diplomat or his or her wife or husband, then Boris Johnson ultimately will be responsible.
It was interesting yesterday, just after Boris Johnson made those comments, how the Russian embassy in London reacted, and what it had to say basically was, well, Russia can point to what it's done in Syria, you may argue with it, but what's Britain done?
The Russian military campaign in Syria, which began over a year ago, is being carried out in accordance with international law. Why do I say that? Because the Syrian government, led by President Assad, which is the only legitimate authority in Syria, and that is in line with the UN Charter and international law in general, called for assistance from the Russian military. Now, the US-led coalition in Syria, which of course includes Britain, is not acting legally. And the Russian military campaign has helped the Syrian army to liberate much of Syrian territory,
you know,
which was controlled by Islamist terrorists.
You know the argument against that, and that is that Russia is committing war crimes in eastern Aleppo, and is breaking every convention you say they are actually...
Yeah, I mean, I would dispute that because Western governments are citing reports, for example, from what is known as the White Helmets in Syria. Now, the White Helmets officially portray themselves as rescue workers. In reality, they are actually Islamist fighters themselves. There are numerous photos, there are footage of these White Helmets firing RPGs, firing Kalashnikovs, and posing with the bodies of dead Syrian soldiers and dead Syrian civilians in Aleppo.
We were hearing in Richard Galpin's report there from John Saws, former head of MI6, that a no-fly zone, frankly, is unworkable. How would you assess the state of UK-Russian relations today?
The state of relations between London and Moscow are absolutely dreadful, and that is because, in part, Britain does have a very suspicious, hostile attitude towards Russia, historically, and I think also Britain feels left out in Syria. The main two outside forces acting in Syria is, of course, Russia and America, and I think Britain feels, as I said, quite left out and is resorting to some, quite frankly speaking, disgraceful means. For example, encouraging protests outside the Russian embassy, and the Russian embassy is, as I said, completely right to complain about that.
The perception that many in the West have that this is President...
Okay. I would like to hear that kind of conversation on CNN or MSNBC, but you won't, and that's unfortunate. And I'll be doing an entire special on the propaganda campaign in the United States to promote the White Helmets as these virtuous peace givers, lifesavers. They are not. And once again, it's on the left more often than not that the lie is told. So we have a group of guests from Syria coming on, experts from Syria, and telling us about how the White Helmets have partnered with media outlets and fundraising foundations to give a one-sided story, far from working for peace and promoting an escalation of the war and demanding a no-fly zone from which to work for the overthrow of the government. In fact, the U.S. government gave the White Helmets $23 million with which to work on this so-called transition to a different government. So there's a whole other story there that the media is not allowing you to know about. Now, what happens when you have a disaster in Haiti, the earthquake, and now the hurricane, and you want to send money? You give it to the Red Cross. I wouldn't give the Red Cross anything. By the way, I wouldn't give that New York Blood Bank anything. Do you remember many months ago I had found out a story about how this poor, lonely, old chimpanzee was living on an island after it had been used and abused in experiments through the blood bank, and then they stopped feeding it, and there was no food or water on the island, and only some people that would take it out. And that thing just broke my heart, so I immediately tried to find, was there anyone near the island that I could speak with, that I could send food for the animal, because I know primates very well, and even pay someone to take care of the animal. Then I found out it wasn't just that animal. There's 56 of them that this blood bank. So I wouldn't give the blood bank another penny, not a penny. It made, I think, $300 million last year. And I'm going to be mentioning the people in that blood bank, how much money they made, and how they stopped funding the care of these creatures that they used, abused, in my opinion, tortured, where they didn't have to do any of that. And now they leave them to die? Well, I'm reaching out today after this show to every single member of the board of the New York Blood Bank and to all the officers, asking them to come on this program and explain to us how they could be so mercenary, so selfish, and careless and reckless. I will be giving the results of that tomorrow. In any case, we have found a way to help them through the ASPCA, but they need to do a lot more. In any case, so imagine what happens when you give the Red Cross, an organization that I cannot stand the Red Cross, they're so corrupt, and they took $500 million. Think of how many meals that would have provided. Think of the grains that would have, the seeds to grow new crop. Think of the shelters you could have built. Think of the irrigation system you could have been in and the water system. Think of the wells you could have done. Think of sanitation you could have given for $500 million. And they built six little tiny houses and kept all the rest of it, 99% they kept. And yet people will still give to them. So who made the most money and gave the least? $12 billion. Hillary and Bill Clinton and their foundation. Listen in. This is the former president of the Haitian Senate.
We had an earthquake that killed 315,000 people. That's really a deadly earthquake, and millions were left without shelter. President Obama named Bill Clinton as the one that should be in charge of the reconstruction of Haiti. And in that process, the Clinton Foundation, through U.S. taxpayers' money, and people giving money worldwide to the Clinton Foundation for relief effort to Haiti, contributed about $14.3 billion. We're talking about $1 billion, okay? The Haitian people has not seen not even 2% of that money.
2%?
Nothing was done in Haiti. They were given those contracts. They were given millions of dollars from that money, and nothing was actually done in Haiti. Yeah. Haiti, just like everything the Clinton have done, is pay for play, and they control Haiti, and they have been controlling Haiti since 1994 when they invaded Haiti. I mean, what the Clinton have done in Haiti is unbelievable, and the American people should know about it.
Yeah.
I'll be joining the Haitian demonstrations this week also, as I did in the last one in front of Bill Clinton's office to protest, and I'll be bringing some articles for the people that document how much money the Clintons have made in the name of Haiti, and what they've done, which is nothing for the Haitian people. Let's say hello from Los Angeles to Stuart. Hi, Stuart, your turn.
Hi, Gary. Before I answer that, after that, can I ask you something about organic that you talked about?
Okay. Yes.
So, in response to your request, I've thought about this for a long time with animals, slaughterhouses, and what it would take. And the bottom line, like you said, people are concerned about their income, their jobs, and so my solution that I thought of over and over is to find people jobs and educate them about how what they're doing is affecting their health. So I think the bottom line is finding them something else for income. And that gets involved, how to go about that and all. But that's basically as far as I went as thinking about that. From time to time, I try to think about what to do.
At what point do you enable someone who is refusing to do anything on their own except continue to be a part of a system that is destructive to the larger economy as well as themselves? Do you believe that the average person has any responsibility whatsoever to become aware of the consequences of what they do? Stuart, I'm looking at the clock, and unfortunately we're out of time, but I thank you for calling in. I thank you for stimulating some thought. All the best to you. And we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you all. Mia from the Bronx, I'm sorry we won't get to you today. And the drug that kills black women, I'll deal with tomorrow. Thank you all for listening. Have a good day.